KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump and Russia's President Putin talked for more than 2 hours. It did not lead to a ceasefire in Ukraine, but there's talk of the Vatican hosting future negotiations. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Russia seems to be building up its military installations near its border with Finland. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Satellite imagery might be signaling Russia's next move when the Ukraine war ends. Also, what's the real purpose of OpenAI? A reporter who covered the company for years says it evolved. It went from a nonprofit trying to save the world to an empire sucking up data and resources. It's Tuesday, May 20th. Happy birthday to the icon, the legend, Cher. She's 79 today. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Ceasefire talks between Israel and Hamas are at an impasse. As NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv, three major allies of Israel are calling on the Israeli government to end its latest military campaign in Gaza.
Qatar is hosting Israel-Hamas negotiations. Prime Minister Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani told the Qatar Economic Forum talks, quote, didn't lead us anywhere yet.
We couldn't bridge this fundamental gap.
He says the gap is that Israel wants a partial hostage release deal and temporary ceasefire, and Hamas wants a full hostage release and permanent end of the war. Meanwhile, the leaders of the UK, France, and Canada are calling on Israel to end its latest offensive in Gaza and allow essential supplies into civilians or face consequences. On Monday, Israel said it allowed a small number of trucks into Gaza with baby food after nearly 3 months of a blockade, and Israel says it will allow in flour, food, and medical supplies. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
A new book is alleging that White House staff concealed the declining health of former President Biden when he was in office. The book is called Original Sin, President Biden's Decline, Its Cover-Up, and His Disastrous Choice to Run Again. Biden's team had told many that the then president was doing well, but the book's co-author, Alex Thompson of Axios, says interviews with other people close to Biden told a different story.
The one top aide who left the White House said that they intentionally shielded him from other members of the administration, other members of the cabinet, other senior White House officials. The inner circle became smaller and smaller, and this White House official said that was intentional so that they did not realize the extent of the decline.
He spoke to NPR. Biden disclosed over the weekend he has stage 4 prostate cancer. His office says it appears the disease will respond to treatment. President Trump initially said he thought Biden's diagnosis was very sad, but Trump later said, without evidence, Biden had delayed sharing the information. The U.S. Supreme Court is allowing the Trump administration to end temporary legal status for 350,000 Venezuelan migrants. NPR's Ximena Bustillo reports the move reverses a Biden-era decision.
The Trump administration sought to reverse temporary protected status for Venezuelans after former President Biden extended it in 2023. A federal judge paused the White House's plans a week before protections were scheduled to expire. The Trump administration appealed that decision to the U.S. Supreme Court in an emergency application. The court didn't weigh in on whether the Trump administration could end TPS for Venezuelans permanently. That continues to be litigated in lower courts. Ximena Bustillo, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street and pre-market trading, Dow futures are slightly lower. This is NPR. Authorities in Louisiana have recaptured a fourth inmate who escaped from a New Orleans jail last Friday, but six others remain on the loose. NPR's Giles Snyder reports state officials are launching an investigation into operations at the city jail.
Louisiana Attorney General Liz Merle says the investigation is aimed at preventing any future incident, saying the investigation will look into any deficiencies that may have led to the jailbreak. The sheriff who oversees the jail says defective locks were a key factor and that the inmates might have received help from within her department.
NPR's Giles Snyder reporting. Some of the Trump administration's cuts to the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, are being felt in an unexpected place, high school science fairs. Henry Larson reports from Boulder, Colorado.
In February, sophomore Max Kurtz presented a project at Boulder Valley School District's annual science fair. It measured microbial activity in soil, which could help farmers get better crop yields. Kurtz won an award, and then, days later, the prize was walked back. That's because his award was sponsored by USAID. In February, the agency cut its contract with the organization that coordinated Max's fair and hundreds of others around the world. Also on the chopping block, prize money for an international competition later this year. In an emailed statement, a State Department spokesperson said supporting science fair awards didn't fit within the department's standards for U.S. foreign assistance. For NPR News, I'm Henry Larson in Boulder.
And I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Imaginable Futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at imaginablefutures.com. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Coming up, what's next for hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans who could now lose their legal protections to live in the U.S.?
First, President Trump spoke with Russia's leader Vladimir Putin for more than 2 hours on Monday. They discussed ending the war in Ukraine, and Trump gave an account of the call.
I said, when are we going to end this, Vladimir? I've known him for a long time now. I said, when are we going to end this bloodshed, this bloodbath? It's a bloodbath.
Trump claimed some success towards peace, but Putin again resisted Trump's calls for an immediate ceasefire. Putin proposed more talks, which would take place even as the war continues.
NPR's Charles Maines has been covering all this from Moscow. Hey there, Charles.
Morning, Steve.
What did this call accomplish?
You know, both sides were really complimentary about the tone of the conversation itself, which Trump called excellent and Putin said was constructive and useful. But the two leaders seemed at odds about what had actually been achieved. Trump took to social media to say Russia had agreed to immediately start ceasefire talks and, more importantly, in Trump's words, seek an end to the war. But in a brief statement to journalists, Putin suggested he was in no hurry.
Договорились с президентом Соединенных Штатов о том, что...
So here Putin says he agreed with Trump to work with Ukraine on a memorandum about a possible future peace deal, but made clear all sorts of details needed to be worked out before they could possibly lead to a ceasefire of some defined length. And moreover, Putin again emphasized that any peace deal would still have to address what he called the root causes of the conflict. You know, that's always been Kremlin speak for Russia's fundamental desire to control Ukraine, and Ukraine knows it.
So, not really changing any of the demands that Putin has had since 2022. How did Ukraine respond?
Well, I think it's first important to point out that Trump held talks with Ukrainian leader Volodymyr Zelensky before the Putin conversation and after, so Trump is certainly giving Zelensky time and attention. But Zelensky has to be sensitive to offending Trump's desire to show progress here, or at least not appear to be seen as an obstacle to peace, all the more so because Trump is also suggesting new business opportunities for both Russia and Ukraine once the fighting ends. So speaking after the call, Zelensky repeated Ukraine's support for a full and immediate ceasefire. there, even as he really made clear he does not trust Putin's motives in these negotiations or Putin's blurring of the language of peace. Let's listen.
But of course, Russia is Russia. They want something, but they even don't know what they want. And when they say they want something, they want everything.
Okay, so hard to see what the progress is, but we do have France, Germany, and the UK, other players here, threatening more sanctions against Russia if Putin doesn't agree to an immediate ceasefire. How do they see all this?
You know, Putin's refusal to sign to this ceasefire deal puts Europe in an odd position. You know, do you let Trump's peace efforts play out or risk undermining them with pressure on Moscow now? That said, even if Europe does choose to impose additional sanctions, Russian analysts say the Kremlin fundamentally doesn't see it as a threat. Here's Ivan Timofeyev with the Russian International Affairs Council in Moscow.
Sanctions are inflicting harm, but this harm is not critical for macroeconomic stability of Russia. And actually, further escalation of sanctions would hardly be critical as well.
You know, so the result, says Timofeyev, is that Russia remains convinced it can simply afford to continue the conflict if or when these peace negotiations break down. So Moscow really sees little incentive to compromise here.
Charles, thanks very much for breaking that down. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
NPR's Charles Maines in Moscow.
Russia is building up its military presence along its borders with NATO countries, the latest reportedly with Finland. That's raising concerns across Europe as the U.S. retreats from its support for the decades-old alliance. Nations that share a border with Russia are especially concerned, including Finland and former Soviet Baltic states like Estonia and Latvia. Fiona Hill joins me now to discuss. She's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, a nonprofit think tank based in Washington, D.C. She's also served as Senior Director for European and Russian Affairs on the U.S. National Security Council during President Trump's first administration. Good morning. Thanks for being on the program.
Good morning, Lila. Thanks for having me.
So what is Russia's President Vladimir Putin signaling to Europe by boosting its military presence along the border of NATO allies like this?
Well, I think the significant thing here, Leila, is that unfortunately, this is the return of the Russian troops rather than a boost of the troops. The Finns were expecting this. It's the longest border between a NATO country and Russia, the Finnish border. And what happened was when the Russians were building up their forces in Ukraine or on the border with Ukraine in anticipation of their invasion, the Finns noted that they pulled the troops away from that border, and the Finns were extraordinarily concerned about what would happen, obviously, if the troops went back again, which is what we've seen, and they've been preparing for that eventuality, including through their decision to join NATO in the first instance. We also have the NATO summit coming up in a few weeks, around June 24th, and it's very clear from this pattern that Russia always adopts ahead of some big event for the Europeans or for Ukraine, for example, like the peace talks. We had a huge drone attack on Ukraine, that Russia likes to signal that it's there, that it's ready, that it's in a constant state of vigilance.
So is it just symbolic then? I mean, why do this when the Russian military has suffered major losses in the war in Ukraine? I mean, does Russia actually have the capacity for a conflict with a NATO member, which would then possibly trigger a fight with its NATO allies?
Well, Russia has a lot of capacity for intimidation. We've got all kinds of sabotage operations going on. We've got threats to critical national infrastructure, which we've already seen. It's not just the question of, you know, men on the border, you know, preparing for a prospective invasion. There's obviously a deterrence and intimidation element to all of this. It's certainly not symbolic and it's not performative, but the Russians are using all kinds of different tactics at the moment. But what it is a signal to Finland and to other vulnerable countries on the border that Russia is there. And, you know, given what we heard in the last segment, the militarized economy, there's an awful lot of incentives for Putin to keep on building up the military, even if things on the battlefield are not going as he desires, because he's got the constant state of readiness in the Russian armed forces. He needs no excuses to keep people in the military. He's going to have a very hard time dismantling this military apparatus that he's set up. And, you know, he'll want it back on those key borders with NATO countries. So it's a concern not just for Finland, but also for Norway, as we've already mentioned, the Baltic states, and for countries like Poland that are also in the vicinity.
How are European leaders responding to these buildups?
Well, they're getting very serious about it. We've just had a summit between the UK and the European Union, for example, where they've talked about security and tried to reset their relationship. There's a whole host of discussions about the prospects of the European members of NATO building up their own pillar of security. The European Union's put money to one side now to boost its defence. Most of the European countries now are boosting their own defence. The UK has done the same. The UK is about to roll out a strategic defence review that talks very directly about what's happening with Russia and also in Ukraine. So we can see they're getting prepared. The risk for the United Kingdom and for the Europeans writ large now is that Russia gets, you know, aggressive much more quickly than anticipated. You know, we've talked about this 3 to 5 year time frame, and, you know, it's going to take some time for them to be able to bridge over to their own capacities and move away from the dependency on the United States. So we're seeing an awful lot of manoeuvring at this moment, and, you know, particularly the Russians trying to take advantage, you know, of what's happening in the United States with discussions about retrenchment from Europe, and hoping that they'll be able to intimidate the Europeans in that gap, in that vacuum that we may have.
Really quickly then, with the U.S., if you could just expand on that. I mean, there's just a total vacuum, no dependence on the U.S. at this point. Europe is going to try to depend on itself.
Yes, that's exactly what's trying to happen. They're trying to persuade the United States to stay in the game in terms of guaranteeing European security until they, you know, fully have their act together in terms of building up their own defense capacities. But we're seeing that, and I think that's one of the reasons why Russia's moving.
That's Fiona Hill. She's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Thank you for being back on the program.
Thanks, Leila.
Many Venezuelans in the United States do not know what the future holds. The Supreme Court ruled that 350,000 may be stripped of their legal status. NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran reports.
Monday's ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court was short and unsigned. It allowed the Trump administration to revoke the Temporary Protected Status, or TPS, of hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans. But it did not provide additional details. This has caused confusion and extreme concerns, says Ahilan Arulanandam. He's with the Center for Immigration Law and Policy at UCLA and one of the lawyers representing the Venezuelans.
Definitely one reading of the decision is that the 350,000 Venezuelan TPS holders have just lost their status and employment authorization right now.
He said it's up to the Trump administration to decide the next steps. When ending the Biden-era TPS extension for Venezuelans, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem said continuing the program is contrary to U.S. national interests. Noem basically said that because some Venezuelan migrants in the U.S. have ties to Tren de Aragua, a Venezuelan gang, TPS for every Venezuelan should be terminated. A spokeswoman for DHS called the ruling, quote, a win for the American people and the safety of our communities. But for plaintiff Cecilia Gonzalez, the ruling is nothing more than devastating. She fled Venezuela in 2017.
This administration and their cruel choices are disregarding any basic humanity that we're seeking for.
According to U.S. law, presidents have the power to grant TPS to immigrants of a specific country if conditions there prevent them from returning safely. In Venezuela, political persecution, violence, and other problems have pushed Gonzalez and about 8 million others out of their country since 2014.
Returning to Venezuela is not safe at all. The administration has acknowledged the risk.
But DHS Secretary Noem said recently the administration believes conditions have improved there. That's despite the State Department cautioning Americans with the agency's highest level advisory not to travel to Venezuela, citing the high risk of wrongful detention, terrorism and kidnappings, poor health infrastructure, and other serious challenges. Attorneys for the Venezuelans say they will continue to appeal this case in the district court. Sergio Martinez Beltran, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
on the next Fresh Air. CNN host Jake Tapper talks about his new book, Original Sin, President Biden's decline, its cover-up, and his disastrous choice to run again. Tapper says the book goes to universal questions about groupthink, courage, cowardice, and patriotism. He adds, this doesn't excuse or normalize President Trump's actions. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students by sharing what works in pre-K through 12 education, at edutopia.org. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We have a skeptical look at one of the most famous companies of our time. Karen Howe wrote it. She's a journalist who first covered OpenAI 6 years ago when it was promising to develop artificial intelligence ethically.
It was founded as a research nonprofit meant to do this kind of fundamental research for, as it said, the benefit of all of humanity. And it was meant to open source that research to be for the public benefit.
The word open was right there in the name. OpenAI had the backing of tech giants, including Elon Musk, who worried about AI's future effects on the world. So Karen Howe arranged to spend time in the company's offices as a young reporter for the MIT Technology Review. Her experience led her to ask questions, which eventually led to a book called Empire of AI. It explores the company's research, its development of ChatGPT, its firing and restoration of CEO Sam Altman, and more.
They were incredibly secretive, which didn't seem quite right because, first of all, that's the opposite of transparent. But second of all, why would you be secretive if you're a nonprofit that's purely doing research in the interest of the public? You would be secretive if you might have some kind of commercial intent. Also, they were incredibly competitive. When I was interviewing executives, they really emphasized that they needed to be number one in AI progress. They needed to be first to what they called artificial general intelligence. And to me, there was an inherent tension in wanting to be first and wanting to be open.
I feel that you helped me understand that this is more than a clash of personalities. You have people who are worried about the future of humanity, the future of the planet, and thinking we need to develop artificial intelligence in an ethical way, and that's why this should be a nonprofit. But we also need to be ahead of everybody else in order to shape things, and therefore we need to be really good, and therefore we need to get immense investment, and therefore we need to attach for-profit motives to the non-profit. I mean, they kind of reason themselves out of their own original idea.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think a lot of OpenAI and AI development in general is very much an ideological clash, not just personality clashes. Certainly, they're huge personalities, and they're all very egotistical, and they all want to be the one that makes AI in their image. But there are these deep-seated kind of quasi-religious beliefs that also underpin the whole thing, where some people believe that AI could have the potential to bring the world to utopia, and they want to run as fast as possible to that objective. And other people believe that AI has the possibility to destroy humanity, and they want to run fast to the finish line of building this powerful technology so that they're the ones that ensure that it's not another quote-unquote bad actor that is going to do it first and therefore lead to the demise of humanity.
Who is Sam Altman, and what did he bring to the table, given that he himself was not an inventor or a brilliant engineer?
He's a once-in-a-generation fundraising talent. That is his particular skill. And he's also a once-in-a-generation storytelling talent, which is effectively why he's so good at fundraising. He is able to paint these extremely persuasive visions of the future. He was already prominent within Silicon Valley, and Silicon Valley very much runs on stories and telling stories about the future. And one of the things that I sort of concluded through the reporting of my book is that when he says something to someone, what he's saying is more tightly correlated with what he thinks they need to hear than what he actually believes or the ground truth of the thing. He's able to say the things that really provoke people to kind of rally towards a general broad sweeping mission that he paints.
So a few bottom line questions. Has OpenAI remained the leader in artificial intelligence?
It's an interesting question because it depends on how you would measure it. In terms of name recognition, you could argue that they are the lead because most people have heard of ChatGPT. I recently was talking with some application developers who use AI models for their platform, for their service. And application developers are now moving towards a model where they are trying to make their platforms AI vendor agnostic. And so in terms of the actual capability of the technology, it seems like increasingly AI has become commoditized and OpenAI doesn't necessarily have a meaningful lead anymore.
Can you tell me one more thing? You call the book Empire of AI, and you make an extended comparison to old-time colonial empires of the 1800s, say. What are you talking about?
We are essentially seeing the recreation of how empires of old used to work. Like, empires of old, there were a small group of people at the top that were able to make decisions for everyone else around the world. And basically everyone else around the world didn't have agency, didn't have say, and they lived in the thrash of the decisions that were happening at the top based on the whims of the people at the top. And we are now in basically the same situation. I mean, the empires of AI, as I mentioned in the book, they're not as overtly violent as empires of old because we've had 150 years of moral and social progress. So they're not going to be using the kind of same violent methods to do the exploitation and extraction, but they are still exploiting lots of labor around the world in the sense that they are starting to apply real pressure to people's ability to receive economic opportunity by creating technologies that automate away a lot of work. And they're also seizing up a lot of resources to continue fortifying their empire. They're seizing up land for their data centers. They're seizing up data that people put online without the realization that it would be commoditized and used to turn a profit. And we have to be extremely cognizant because if we follow this path to its logical conclusion, democracy cannot survive in a world where the vast majority of people no longer have agency and say and control over their own lives.
Karen Howe is a journalist and the author of Empire of AI. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
We will note Sam Altman did not give Karen Howe an interview for the book. NPR reached out to OpenAI for comment and they did not respond. It's NPR News.
Dawn Staley has won 3 national championships as a basketball coach and 3 Olympic gold medals as a basketball player. In her memoir, Uncommon Favor, she says she's trying to pay it forward.
It's given me a life that, for most, you read about a life that I have. And it's a debt that I'm trying to repay.
Coach Dawn Staley on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Trump is on Capitol Hill this morning. He's meeting with House Republicans as they move closer to a vote on a budget bill that reflects the president's legislative priorities on issues such as border security and an extension of tax cuts. Here's House Speaker Mike Johnson.
I think the president is going to encourage everyone this morning
to get in line and get the votes done.
Johnson says he expects a vote on the bill before the end of the week. House Democrats oppose it, arguing the spending cuts will hurt people who are on Medicaid. The National Transportation Safety Board says investigators in New York will be looking at three main areas as they examine the weekend collision of a Mexican Navy ship with the Brooklyn Bridge.
The crew and the operation of the crew, the vessel and the condition of the vessel, and finally the environment, and that includes the weather, the wind, the current, the tide.
That's NTSB member Michael Graham. Investigators say the ship departed a pier with a tugboat and increased its speed just before the collision, in which the ship's three masts snapped when hitting the bridge span. Two crew members were killed in that collision. More than a dozen others aboard that ship were injured. This is NPR News from Washington. Former Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms says she's entering the race for governor of Georgia. The 55-year-old Democrat officially entered the race this morning. Bottoms and State Senator Jason Estevez are seeking the party's gubernatorial nomination, along with Pastor Olu Brown. Governor Brian Kemp, a Republican, is barred from seeking a third term. The state's attorney general, Republican Chris Carr, is seeking the GOP nomination. Later today at the UN, members of the General Assembly will be looking at human rights abuses and violations in North Korea. As Linda Fasulo reports, this will be the UN's first such high-level meeting on that issue.
The UN General Assembly, which approved the special session, strongly condemned what it called systematic, widespread, and gross violations of human rights in North Korea, including possible crimes against humanity. And, among other things, it noted that North Korea supports its military and nuclear weapons programs through human rights abuses, including the use of forced labor. It also expressed concern that a disproportionate share of its budget is spent on the military to the detriment of its people. It's not clear if any General Assembly action will be taken, or if North Korea, which rejected the resolution in December, will participate in the high-level session. For NPR News, Linda Fasulo in New York.
Stocks on Wall Street opened lower moments ago. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Layla Faudin. Good morning. A woman in Georgia has been declared brain dead, but she's being kept on life support because she's pregnant. The case is raising complicated legal questions about restrictive abortion laws in Georgia and other states. WABE's Sam Greenglass has been following the story and joins us from Atlanta. Good morning, Sam.
Hey, Layla.
So, Sam, just tell me more about this case.
Adriana Smith was about 9 weeks pregnant in February when doctors declared her brain dead. The 30-year-old nurse and mom had suffered a medical emergency. But Smith's family says doctors at Emory University Hospital have been keeping her organs functioning until the fetus can be delivered. They're citing Georgia's law banning most abortions after roughly 6 weeks. Smith's mother, April Newkirk, spoke to TV station WXIA.
My grandson may be blind, may not be able to walk. We don't know if he'll live once she has him. And I'm not saying that we would have chose to terminate her pregnancy. What I'm saying is we should have had a choice.
So this mother doesn't get to make the choice about the fate of her daughter and her daughter's unborn child. And it's been 3 months now because of what the hospital has decided. Is it clear that Georgia's abortion law would prevent the hospital from taking Smith off life support? Is it part of the law?
Well, after this case became public, a Democratic state senator wrote to Georgia's Republican Attorney General Chris Carr asking for clarity here. And his office responded saying there's nothing in Georgia's abortion law that requires a woman be kept on life support after brain death. That would be because removing life support is not an action done for the purpose of terminating a pregnancy. Now, Emory Healthcare seems to have come to a different conclusion. The hospital has not addressed the AG's legal opinion, but did release a statement last week saying treatment decisions are based on, quote, consensus from clinical experts, medical literature, and legal guidance in compliance with Georgia's abortion laws and all other applicable laws.
Okay, then why the disconnect between the AG and the hospital?
Well, I put that question to University of California Davis Law Professor Mary Ziegler. She pointed to two Georgia women whose deaths drew national attention last year. Mm-hmm. ProPublica reported that a state panel ruled the deaths preventable and likely the result of doctors being slow or unwilling to provide abortion care because of Georgia's law. Ziegler told me that many medical providers in states with restrictive abortion laws have become a lot more risk averse, you know, running afoul of the law can carry criminal penalties.
The scenario in Georgia right now is an example of that, where you have the attorney general saying, no problem, go ahead. And you're having doctors and their lawyers reading the law and saying, we're not so sure.
Ziegler says one reason the hospital may have been not so sure in this case at Emory is because of a provision in Georgia's abortion law known as fetal personhood.
Fetal personhood, what's that?
Fetal personhood is the idea that embryos and fetuses are people and have legal rights. In Georgia, for example, people can claim a fetus as a dependent on state taxes. Ziegler told me establishing fetal personhood has long been a goal of the anti-abortion movement. And now that Roe v. Wade has been struck down, some of these personhood laws are being enforced, and that has consequences, like with this Georgia case, and potentially in other areas like in vitro fertilization or even the census. And as these cases result in legal challenges, that could bring the issue to the U.S. Supreme Court. Meanwhile, in Georgia, Adriana Smith remains on life support at Emory University Hospital.
WABE's Sam Greenglass. Thank you, Sam.
Thanks, Layla.
One of the most contentious parts of the budget bill in Congress is cuts to Medicaid. That's the public health insurance program for Americans who are disabled or have limited income. To understand the numbers and what they mean, A. Martinez spoke with health economist Lindsay Allen at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine.
So, Lindsay, the Congressional Budget Office estimates a savings of about $625 billion to the national deficit. The office also thinks that up to 10.3 million people could lose coverage over a decade. Is this gamble even worthwhile?
I don't know that I can say the gamble is worthwhile, because the CBO estimates actually rely on some pretty big assumptions. One of them is assuming that the states are going to somehow replace the lost federal funding, and that's something that many of the states just can't or won't do. So in practice, the cost burden is just shifting to states and local governments and hospitals and families. And we suspect that more people are going to lose coverage than the CBO estimated.
So ultimately, you're saying someone has to pay.
Absolutely. It just shifts the burden of paying for that care to someone else.
Yeah. So let's take a step back for a second. Broadly, what does it mean to Medicaid recipients to lose coverage? What's the impact on their health and also maybe their wallet?
Yeah, absolutely. So Medicaid is a health and economic engine. And so when you receive Medicaid, you end up being able to get care for conditions that need treating. So if you lose Medicaid, you don't end up actually having that need for care go away.
Yeah. Okay, so let's dig into some of the specific proposals here. One is to require able-bodied adults without dependents to prove they're working or training for a job as a condition to secure Medicaid coverage. If this requirement, Lindsay, goes through, how could that impact coverage?
Well, that sounds wonderful in theory, but something like 91% of the individuals that this bill would be targeting with work requirements are caring for family, they're in school, or they're dealing with health issues that aren't always visible or formally diagnosed. So the policy is not really changing behavior, it's just stripping coverage from people who are already contributing in ways that the system just doesn't recognize.
You know, I happened to be in Georgia at the time when Governor Brian Kemp was really, really pushing work requirement for Medicaid coverage, 80 hours of work or volunteer activities. I know that Arkansas was the first state to do it back in 2018. How has that turned out for these states?
What we've seen, so especially in Arkansas and now more recently Georgia, is that the coverage loss is happening not because people aren't eligible, but because they get stuck in paperwork. So the red tape is dense and confusing, especially for people who are juggling multiple jobs or they're caregiving or they're dealing with their health issues.
So what would be some other ways to streamline Medicaid and maybe better serve its most vulnerable beneficiaries without drastically reducing access to healthcare?
Sure. So if we want to cut Medicaid costs without hurting people, the data point us toward things like reducing prescription drug prices or cracking down on high cost, low value care, or investing in preventive services that are what actually lower long-term costs, unlike policies that just cut people off.
That's health economist Lindsay Allen. She's an assistant professor at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Lindsay, thank you.
Thank you, A.
This is NPR News.
I'm Asma Khalid. New questions about former President Biden's fitness in office. In a new book, CNN's Jake Tapper claims a cognitive decline was covered up.
We're talking about to the point of you are not able to have a conversation. You are not able to come up with data, names that you should have at the ready.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Good morning, I'm Leila Fadel. Campers were exploring a national park in California last month when they came across a weak and hungry two-month-old black bear cub. They called authorities, who tried to reunite the cub with its mother, but she was nowhere to be found.
So he ended up in a local humane society. Workers wanted to feed him while keeping him wild, so they dressed up as bears, mimicking the actions of a mother bear. Thanks to the Care Bears, the cub is now healthy and will eventually return to the wild. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering hydrangeas, lilacs, evergreens, and more. Their full collection is at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Kentuckians are recovering from last weekend's tornadoes, and they might be in for more dangerous weather today, according to the National Weather Service. Much of southern Kentucky is at high risk for a significant tornado just days after a burst of storms killed more than 24 people in that state, as well as in Missouri and Virginia.
Earlier this spring, another cluster of deadly tornadoes tore across 8 states in the Midwest. So is climate change making tornadoes more frequent?
It's a question we pose from time to time, and NPR's Rebecca Hersher is here to talk through the evidence. Good morning.
Good morning.
First, has this been a particularly bad spring for tornadoes?
Well, yes, it actually has. There have been more tornadoes than average, and that's according to data from the National Weather Service. So usually by this time in May, there have been a little over 600 tornadoes reported in the U.S. But this year, there have been more than 850 tornadoes, so significantly more.
Okay, so is this just a bad year, or is there evidence that the frequency is increasing in a real way over time?
It's just a bad year. You know, the annual number of storms varies a lot year to year, so it's not surprising to have a really active year or two like this year. I spoke to a tornado expert about this. Her name is Melissa Widhelm, and she helps lead the Midwestern Regional Climate Center at Purdue University.
There's not really an increase or a decrease in the overall number of tornadoes that we see. That number's been pretty stable.
You know, year after year, that's going back to the 1950s. But here's what is changing. She says big outbreaks of tornadoes, like the ones in Kentucky and Missouri over the weekend, those are getting more common, where lots of storms move over a really large area in a short period of time.
Oh, this is interesting. And this is a thing that people have said about climate change, that you end up with more extreme weather events. So not more tornadoes total, but more of these clusters of tornadoes.
Yeah, exactly. And Widhelm says those clusters or outbreaks are a new phenomenon.
In the past, we didn't see the kind of large outbreak days that we do now. It used to be kind of unusual to see dozens of them in a day, and now we get that year after year.
Now, she points out that warning people about those big clusters is really labor intensive. You know, it requires a lot of weather forecasters and radar data to track the storms as they move across multiple states, which is notable at a time when the Trump administration is cutting weather forecasting budgets. And there are a lot of vacancies in the National Weather Service. You know, during the outbreak over the weekend, the local weather service office in Jackson, Kentucky, had to borrow forecasters from other offices in the region because they didn't have enough staff on their own. And that's according to a statement from the National Weather Service.
Appreciate that last detail. It is the National Weather Service acknowledging this in a statement. So let's try to figure out what's going on. We understand that climate change can lead to more extreme weather events. We have these more extreme weather events, but can we be a little more precise about the mechanics? Do scientists understand why big outbreaks of tornadoes are getting more common?
I wish I could say yes, but unfortunately, tornadoes are very complex, and this is just one of many unanswered questions about how they're changing, especially as the climate changes. You know, in general, climate change is causing more severe weather, as you said. One of the ingredients for a tornado is moist, warm air. So obviously, as the atmosphere heats up, it makes sense that tornado conditions could show up more. There have been some studies that suggest that there might be more tornadoes in the fall and winter as the earth heats up, as opposed to now, when most tornadoes happen in the spring and summer. But it's really an area of active research.
Rebecca, thanks so much.
Thanks.
That's NPR's Rebecca Hersher. This is NPR News. On a Tuesday, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. The CEO and president of CBS News and stations, Wendy McMahon, is resigning. She says she does not agree with corporate leadership on, quote, the path forward. As NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik reports, CBS's parent company is seeking to settle a lawsuit filed against the network by President Trump.
Last fall, as a private citizen, Trump filed a $10 billion lawsuit over an interview with then-Vice President Kamala Harris. CBS broadcast one portion of her response to a question about Israel and Gaza on Face the Nation, and then another on 60 Minutes.
We're not going to stop pursuing what is necessary for the United States to be clear about where we stand on the need for this war to end.
Trump claimed it was election fraud and that CBS wanted to hide Harris's incoherence. He has since doubled the billions he's seeking. Numerous legal experts have told NPR that Trump doesn't have a case and that his claims fly in the face of the First Amendment's free speech protection. Thing is, controlling owner Sherry Redstone wants to sell CBS's parent company, Paramount Global, to Skydance Media. The buyer is owned by the son of Trump supporter and Oracle founder, Larry Ellison. The Federal Communications Commission has to approve the deal for it to go through because of CBS's local stations. Under Trump's chairman, the FCC has opened an investigation of CBS over the Harris interview. FCC Chief Brendan Carr says he'd be open to suspending CBS's broadcast licenses, something that hasn't been done in decades. Here he is on CNBC.
And over the years, the FCC has stepped back from enforcing that public interest obligation. I think the FCC should do what Congress wants us to do and enforce those laws.
Redstone and Paramount executives have told colleagues that they believe they need to resolve Trump's suit, regardless of the merits, before federal regulators decide whether to approve the company's sale. That's according to several people with knowledge of events granted anonymity to speak about confidential transactions and negotiations. The resignation of CBS News President McMahon comes only a few weeks after 60 Minutes Chief Bill Owens quit. Both were against offering Trump any settlement involving an apology. What lies ahead? Paramount and CBS aren't saying. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
India has taken some blows from the Trump administration. It's an increasingly important strategic partner for the U.S., led by Narendra Modi, who calls President Trump his friend. India has received, in return, 26% tariffs currently suspended. The Trump administration also deported dozens of Indian migrants who were in the U.S. without legal status, and they were sent back shackled and chained. NPR's Dia Hadid reports on how these deportations are seen in India.
A man gives his passport to a Hindu priest in a visa temple in the western Indian city of Ahmedabad. The priest prays to the monkey god Hanuman for this man's visa application to America to be accepted. There are many visa temples across India, and some prayers must be answered. Indians form America's second largest migrant group after Mexico, numbering some 5 million people. There's also Indian migrants in the U.S. without legal status. Their numbers range from 200,000 people to 750,000. Many snuck through America's borders, like Mari Ben's daughter. We met Mari Ben on an Ahmedabad roadside. She sells clay pots for 40 cents profit apiece. Her daughter had bigger dreams. Her daughter and her husband sold their land, borrowed cash, and paid traffickers to sneak them into America with their two children. Mari Ben doesn't give her last name. She fears she'll accidentally identify her daughter and risk her deportation. And deportations are what President Trump promised.
We will begin the process of returning millions and millions of criminal aliens back to the places from which they came.
Just days after his inauguration.
We are now getting some breaking news on the broadcast.
Dozens of Indian nationals were deported in three military flights. Men were shackled and chained in footage shared by Border Patrol set to ominous music. That shocked many Indians because the Prime Minister Narendra Modi boasts of his friendship with Trump. His political rivals goaded him.
Opposition MPs protested outside the parliament, with some even wearing chains to show.
The government said it had raised concerns with the US about deportees being shackled, and officials say thousands of Indian nationals have been deported in the past 15 years. But Modi himself has not commented publicly on how this latest batch of deportees were treated. And India's pro-government media suggested these people deserved what they got, like broadcaster Arnab Goswami.
How do you want criminals to be treated?
Perhaps, he mocked.
These people must be brought back first class with a glass of champagne in their hand.
Analysts say Modi's silence is a political survival strategy. Rajesh Rajagopalan is professor of international politics at Jawaharlal Nehru University.
It's easier to hide rather than seek confrontation with the Trump administration.
He says a spat with Trump might end badly.
We don't want to be targeted either. I mean, we don't want to be another Canada.
We don't want to be Canada. Analysts say India has bigger problems, like finalizing a trade deal they hope will eliminate tariffs that Trump has promised to slap on most Indian goods. But as Modi steers India through this Trump administration, this political headache may keep erupting because Indians may keep trying to reach America. Many of them come from Gujarat, the Prime Minister's home state, like Dingucha village. During a recent visit, cows ambled by as kids whacked a ball in the main square. Many Dingucha residents live in the US, and evidence of their prosperity is everywhere.
Just about every building has been donated by Indians who live abroad. The Hindu temple, the water tanker,
and the municipal building.
For government developing nothing.
Inside, Administrator Jayesh Chaudhary says it's Indian Americans who've developed Dingucha, and that signals to folks here that fortunes are made in America. Just from this village, one family, parents and their two children, froze to death 3 years ago as they crossed into the US from Canada during a blizzard. Relatives of that family were recently deported on a Trump administration military flight. Chaudhary says if there's a 1% chance of success, people will keep trying.
Try and try will be success.
And success is reaching America. Dear Hadid, NPR News, Dingucha.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel.